Sound good. Record. And all right, you'll just hear a little intro, and then we'll get started.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks, buddy. And we're back, Stripe Show Podcast, on a Wednesday, PGA Championship Week. I'm your host, Travis Fulton. Today's podcast brought to you by About Golf Simulators. Getting ready to teach today, full day. Six or seven clients coming in, trying to improve their full swing, short game, putting, what happened. We're all in this together, folks. This crazy game of golf. Can we just move the needle the right way? And play just a little bit better golf. And the reality is no matter your skill set, there's going to be good days. There's going to be bad days. And that's just kind of golf, you know. But we got to try to improve our skill set to enjoy this game just a little bit more. And a guy that's really good at improving skill sets when it comes to getting the ball in the hole around the greens joins me from Rochester, New York, John Graham. How are you, buddy?
Yeah, good, thanks. Happy to be here.
A home game for Mr. Indeed. Graham, as yes, he is from Rochester, as he wakes up here on a chilly morning, 32 degrees in New York. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, it's it was the first time I've ever seen a frost delay called in advance. So they texted it out last night that they were going to call a frost delay this morning.
That's unbelievable. I think I broke a sweat, actually, walking from my house to my car here in Florida, but yeah, spring season, right up in the Northeast. I got to tell you, man, I've been looking at this golf course on Golf Channel and some of the pictures I've been seeing on social media, and that being Oak Hill, a place that you know very well. This place looks green. I mean, it just looks absolutely plush.
Yeah, it's been a very interesting winter and early spring season for us. So the winter here was very, very dry. Even though Buffalo got pounded with tons of snowstorms, Rochester only got maybe half of what we normally get. And then we had actually quite an early spring where we had some 80-degree days like a month ago, which is incredibly unusual for us. So like everything just woke right up. And then it rained for like 3 weeks. So the grass here, and this time of year, it's very typical. You just can't even keep up with it. Like the supers here, I was here Friday. And they were saying the grass was going between a half an inch and an inch a day.
Wow!
So like trying to manage it this time of year in the Northeast, if it especially if it gets rainy or something, you almost can't do it. So like it is absolutely, like you said, it is lush and full and very thick.
Had Keith Stewart on yesterday. We were breaking down the field. He's up there as well. We were talking about the course, Oak Hill, the way it played 2013. Jason Duffner versus, let's say, 2023 in this PGA Championship. A lot of changes, you know, from trees being taken down to different sight lines to brand new holes to green complexes. I mean, you name it, it probably happened. So you saw it before, you've seen it now. I mean, what can you tell my audience about Oak Hill and just – the way that perhaps it's going to play, particularly around the greens? I want to get your take around and on the greens. That's your expertise. And perhaps, you know, where that might favor a particular player.
Sure, yeah. So they did a complete redo 2 years ago. So the greens normally in the Northeast is mostly like a Poe bent mix. Mm-hmm. So like there's two golf courses here, the East and the West. East is where they play. The West course, they use a bunch of the greens for the chipping area, driving range, things like that. And you can see a significant difference between the amount of Poe on the West course greens and the East course. East course is completely all bent. So a very different putting surface from normal for an old course in the Northeast. And then the grass that they planted around the green surrounds on the east course when they redid it is also totally different than the grass on the west course. Mm-hmm. So like the grass on the east course is very thick bladed, almost like a St. Augustine grass, but it's like a fescue bluegrass kind of rye mix, but really, really thick blades. Up here, when I was a kid, we used to call it crabgrass. Like, it looked like a weed. Mm-hmm. And that's just like in the green surrounds on the bunker faces, which is also something very different for up here, is the bunkers are all just flat sand and then it's grass faces. So it's not like, you hit it up at the top and it rolls down to the bottom. It can sometimes stick right in the grass side of the hill. They're trying to get that short enough so it will roll back down. But early in the week, it was sticking in, which would be, make it incredibly difficult. Mm. But certainly the players that I think are more familiar with, like the heavy, thick grass types, because so I had James Ridyard staying with me this week, who's a wedge friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the different scenarios for, the balls that go all the way to the bottom is mostly like a bunker explosion type shot. And it's very thick and very sticky. And you almost can't swing too hard because the ball just barely comes out. And then like the mid-height ball that kind of sits halfway down in the rough, is kind of like a tends to work out best. If you have the room to hit kind of like a running, like a drawing type shot to kind of get it out there and get it going, it's pretty manageable. And then the one on top, obviously you can do a lot more with, but, mm-hmm. There's going to be some very difficult stances, I think, this week, more so than some others. Cause, some of the surrounds around the green are quite steep. They've added some, like runoff areas, which for the most part are fast enough and steep enough that the ball actually never finishes in like a fairway lie. It just rolls down the thing and then rolls into the neck of the rough. Sometimes it's right up against the collar, which is now incredibly difficult shot. You've got like a 10-foot rise with a thick Augustine grass in the back and then nothing for the ball. Mm-hmm. So certainly the guys that I think are very familiar with like big floppy type, long rife type explosion shots will be more comfortable and more used to that kind of idea here than those that are not.
So you can't maybe get away with some of the short conservative type of motions. You've got to swing at it a little bit.
You got to swing at it, right? Yeah. Okay. For the most part. Well, I mean, certainly if the ball is a little higher, you can do some more softer things. But if the ball gets down, which is usually the case, because even though it's a thick blade, it's not necessarily it's not full enough per se to keep the ball always fluffy on top. It rolls down to the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a lot more of that type of shot.
What about on the greens? I mean, it sounds like maybe with some of the different green complexes, there might be some different hole locations available to them.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted.
I was going to say, is there how much break on here relative to what these guys are normally seeing?
Pretty typical, I would say. I mean, the thing that they significantly changed is none of the greens are round anymore. They're almost all square or like triangle or trapezoid. So it's very corner based and very obvious kind of where the majority of pins could go. There's a couple that were like, okay, three are obvious. Okay, where does the fourth one kind of go? Mm. But in terms of steepness, they really kind of softened it from what it was. So 13 used to be almost unusable. 15 used to be almost unusable. Now everything is open and up for play in terms of the amount of slope on the green for the where the pins will get cut. There's still some tiers and things that will make it difficult to get to, but the putts around the hole shouldn't be that severe. It'll be the chipping to the hole to get a fairly flattish spot. There's a lot of like I call them crowned saddles. So it's a like on one side, it's high and then low in the middle and then high on the other side. And then 90 degrees to that, it's high in the middle and low on the other side. So it's like a really delicate, kind of subtle, difficult to see and feel and read, both in terms of aim point or just looking at it in terms of what exactly the ball is going to do. Because it looks like one half is going to go this way and the other half is going to go that way. And like, is it going to play mostly straight? Is it going to play one side more than the other? So there's a couple of nice, really tricky pin locations like that.
So you work with a number of players, and I want to talk about a couple of them. Justin Thomas, of course, one of your big-name players you've been with for almost 3 years now. You also work with Adam Svensson, as you've been with for about a year, or just over a year. A lot of people don't know that you consult with Jason Day as well, who of course is having just a fabulous year. Just won the AT&T Byron Nelson last week. You look at the resurgence of Jason Day. I've talked a lot about him on my platforms. Had Chris Como on earlier in the year in January, because you know I could see a lot of the changes that Jason was making in his full swing, and I would text with Chris and say, "Wow, this looks pretty different." You know, I mean, he looks very different in his backswing with his change of knee flex. His club shaft looks shallower coming down. I mean, it's like, you know, some wholesale changes all in an effort to protect his back. And we had him on and we broke that down, and not surprised to see him, you know, flourishing with that. But the other part of his game that's been very consistent and solid is has been his putter. So you consult with him on his putting. Share with my audience, what does a consulting role look like with a player like Jason Day? And then maybe if you could share a couple things that, you know, you feel like are kind of the checkpoints for him that you guys talk about.
Sure thing. Yeah. So this was probably, almost exactly 2 years ago. So it was shortly after the Masters 22 or 21. And Chris had just started working with him maybe 6 months or so prior to that. I can't remember exactly the timing. And Chris asked me to go to Columbus, where Jason lives, and spend a day and do like an assessment on what I think is different from what he's doing now to what he was doing when he was arguably the best putter in the world for years on end. Mm-hmm. And there was a very clear change in the way that he was kind of timing out and accelerating his putting stroke. So he had gotten to a point before I met him that it was getting really, really slow backswing, and then like a really abrupt kind of like bursty follow through. And he was struggling with face control. He was struggling with distance control. And my job obviously was very different than Chris's. My job was more to get him back to where he was, not like we kind of figure everything to protect him. It was like, oh, this is what you used to do, and you were the best in the world at this. Let's figure out what's different. How do we kind of get back there? So the first thing that we started to work with was trying to work through his rhythm and timing again to smooth out his ability to control the face and speed of the club at the ball. And it's mainly just been like kind of visual feel work, a little bit of timing. And then he would say he would end up with this kind of left little quick pull that he would get, and the putter would kind of dart a little left after the ball. And we just kind of talked about a couple different things on what may cause that, and in terms of setup and pivot and kind of how he was powering it. And most of the stuff that we would do in terms of like what my role as a consultant was, is after we had the initial time together, it's like, okay, here's the things I think you should work on. It would mostly be remote video stuff, especially in the off season, because in the wintertime is when he does most of his work. Jason's got a great putting studio at his house, and like a little, almost like a par three course in his yard, where he can do, you know, everything. And so at tournaments, we would just kind of check in, hey, how are things going? Maybe a question here or there, but it was never actual any work. So like nobody would ever see me work with Jason. Right. It was always, you know, either off the course or whatever. Aside from just a couple of questions here and there, hey, I don't think I'm doing this, I'm going to do this, what do you think of this? And like just a brief little 5-minute chat, and then kind of go about our day. And obviously, you know, Jason, because he was so good at it, he just needed to figure out kind of, okay, well, that's where home base used to be. Where am I on the map? How do I get back there? Like, what are the breadcrumbs I need to get back to the place where I was? And once that started to take shape, you know, it's not like he needs me to tell him how to putt great. He already knows how to do that. It's like, you know, here's the directions of how you get back to where you were. And that's all that really was.
So it's interesting. This is something that we talk a lot about here on the podcast, is the rhythm and timing of the stroke. So with Jason, where he would kind of break down a little bit is, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that the putter head would go back slow or slowish, and then it would have to take on a pretty abrupt acceleration phase. Yeah. And would the ratio of the stroke get a little short going back and then longer through?
Exactly.
And then the fix to that, it sounds, was to maybe speed up the backstroke a little bit and maybe lengthen it out a little, and then the finish would get a little shorter.
Exactly. And generally speaking, the speeding it up kind of produces the extra length without having to think about doing both per se. But yeah, it's kind of like swapping that out from a short to long to maybe a slightly longer to shorter. And once I showed him the videos of what he was doing in 15, 16, 17, he was like, oh my God, it's clear as day as soon as you look at it. And it's just trying to figure out, okay, what are the feels that get me back to that place? Mm-hmm. And the strange thing is that's a very common thing that I see in club players, is that they will tend to have the same issue where they get overly short and maybe thoughtful and try to control it. And then they try to add speed all on just the forward side. Now, it wasn't to the extent that I would see it in a club player, but it's a fairly common issue that club players have.
What percent on tour right now do you think, just roughly, that would take it back, you know, let's say a little longer with pace to a little shorter finish versus the other way around?
90%?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's fascinating. I mean, I would have probably put it at, you know, 80, somewhere in there, but 90. Wow, that's a big number. I mean, I did an event here in the studio probably 3 weeks ago, had about 20 people in here, and all of them play a decent amount of golf. I would say probably 10 of them mid single digit handicaps. And I asked them the question. I said, do you think the majority of players take it back short and accelerate to a longer finish, or do you think the majority of players you watch on TV take it back longer with more pace to a shorter finish? And it was predominantly pretty heavy that it was the first way. And I was like, no, it's actually the second way.
The second way, yeah.
After we did the presentation, two guys came up to me and they had this look on their face like, that doesn't even make sense to me. You know, I mean, why would they decelerate through impact? And I was like, well, they're not exactly decelerating. They're just, you know, it has pace and it's kind of more cruise control through the strike.
Right.
And so when you have that cruise control of the pace, because you've loaded the energy going back, then it's a little easier to match it up to, you know, how the ball's coming off the face from a touch perspective, generally speaking, right? And we know that's not the 100%. Case with everybody, but, and so it's one of those you have to talk through, but I really do think, and you make the point with the club player, that when you show them that, like they hit the ball more solid too.
Yes,
like they hit
100%.
It more in the center of the face through that training. So it's just fascinating. And it's something that I really do think that, look, if there's something we can learn from professional players and actually achieve, well, I think what you just described with Jason Day, I think everybody listening, this could probably achieve it.
No doubt. Yeah. This is a very learnable skill. It's just kind of changing how you conceptualize what needs to happen.
Let's talk about Justin Thomas coming in as the defending champ, the PGA. What a comeback last year.
My goodness,
seven shots back going into the final day. I think he bogeyed the first hole, and then he was eight back or something, and then off he comes and catches Mito and wins it
and still comes back.
Yeah, that's right. You just never know in this game, right?
Exactly. You got to keep fighting everybody.
All right, so I wake up this morning and here's a picture of Justin Thomas holding up two fingers in front of his face and looking at a hole. And of course, when we see that, we know there's a little bit of aim point going on. Talk about, if you could, just where we are with JT when it comes to, let's start with this. Where are we with JT from just as a whole with putting? We know he hasn't putted probably as well as he would like, and as we've seen him in the past when he won the PGA, when he won the Players' Championship. But just where are we as a whole, JT, coming in with the flat stick as a starting point?
Yeah, so last year when we kind of looked at how the year went, there was a stretch of putting between, let's say, Riviera and just before the U.S. Open that was probably it was the best putting of his entire professional career, that stretch of putting, and it was mainly due to, let's say, 9 feet and in, like really cleaning up well, saving those pars, making birdie on par five, things like that. And but he wasn't making a ton from like 10 to 16 feet. So when we looked at it after the year, we're like, okay, we're cleaning up well, so obviously, you know, we must be aligning it well, we're reading it okay. Something's not matching up on the mid-range one. Maybe it's a little bit of speed match, something. So let's get to work on that mid-range. Mm-hmm. And we spent a lot of time in that area. And if at least the last time I looked at his stats, this was maybe a week or two ago, like in that 5 to 15-foot range on tour, he was like top 20, like currently is. Like he's in that area exactly where we were trying to get to. But his 5 feet and in has really gone downhill. mainly due to like three putting, his lag putt not getting super close, and then missing the little 4 footer, or 3 footer, or 3.5, 5 footer, whatever the case may be. So his short putting is the main contributor to a statistical difference this year to last year. And most of the work that we'd done the first couple of years was very speed and stroke oriented. But all the way through that time, I'm like, you know, he worked with Matt Killen, Matt knew aim point. He showed him some aim point back in the day. And like, you know, it's a good option. Let's, you know, should we investigate it? Should we explore it? And he's like, yeah, I really didn't feel like I could feel it that well. I feel like I'm reading it okay. Let's just keep going this way. And eventually it got to the point recently where it's like, you know, he would come off the course and Bones and him would say, it's like, I feel like I'm hitting the putts exactly what I'm trying to, and the ball is not doing what I think it should be doing. And then he started talking with Keegan, started talking with Max, and they started playing some matches together. And they were like, oh, yeah, the same point. You got to give this a try. And it was eventually a point where he was like, okay, I'm ready to try something. Mm-hmm. And Bones and I had talked about, you know, aim point as an option for quite a while. We both thought it would be really good for him. And I was kind of waiting for the right window of opportunity where I think I could push it through and he would be like, yeah, okay, let's go ahead and do that. And I just wasn't able to find the right one. And then he just opened it up on his own. He's like, oh, we need to do this. Okay, great. Let's go. Mm-hmm. And so he contacted Mark and had Mark come down and show it to him. And I was there as well. So I could, you know, be the point person after Mark would go back home. Because after he had talked to Max and Keegan, they both kind of said the same thing. Like, we both learned it from Mark. And then Phil Kenyon, who's their putting coach, would be the person that would kind of personalize it for them based on their stroke tendencies, aim, things like that. So it's it always ends up being like a mix of kind of who the person is plus what the math and science says should happen. It's like, okay, how do we put these two together? Because it's usually end up not going to be just all of one or all of the other. So he learned it like 4 days before Wells. I think I flew down the Wednesday. We spent those 4 days working on it, and he put it right into play at Wells Fargo. And it was the best putting that he'd had since Riviera, which I think was the last time he putted quite well. And he was like really excited to do something new again. So like when we had met a few years ago and we talked about some different things that he hadn't really thought of, he's like super excited to get to work. He's like, I got something fresh to do, like something new to chew on. I'm like, let's get at it. And now the same point is kind of that spark mm-hmm. that he was looking for to be like, okay, now I've got something to work on, something new that's different. And it kind of like took all the thought out of a stroke, and he was mm-hmm. able to just focus on speed, and it was like re-energizing, if you will, to just have something to do. And it was so quick and so fast, and it's like his thoughts were a little more decisive and more clear. So far it's been a very good decision. I felt like it would be for a long time. And as time goes on, it'll be this nice mix of aim point and Justin and how he kind of puts the two together going forward, but it's an exciting time.
So what would you say right now coming into this week for him? He's going to use his feet. You're mm-hmm. going to see the fingers up, and then that's going to tell him, based off of the math of aim point, where to aim it. Do you think he'll 100% aim it there, or do you think he'll still kind of use his eyes and then make a calculation?
Oh, he'll still do both. And it really, you talk to at least the majority of the players out here that use it, they're doing the same thing. It's like, it's almost like a yardage where you get it to your ball. It's like, okay, it's 146. That's the numbers. It gives you the aim point. Then you're like, okay, well, it's plus one for uphill, and there's a little bit of wind off the left, so I'm going to play it like 149. Mm-hmm. Aim point is virtually the same thing if you look at it in that way. It's like, okay, well, aim point gives me the answer. The answer is going to be somewhere around here. It's a little bit downhill. Wind's coming off the left. I'm going to play this plus a little or this less a little. It's that same kind of idea. So it's always going to be a little bit of math and a little bit of player feel and a little bit of the environment to come up with the final answer.
What do you think aim point teaches the player when they go through it for the first time? My experience in teaching it is that a player, when they go through it, if they're willing to make mistakes, right? If they're willing to say, all right, it's this is this is what the math is telling me, or what I, at least I think I'm feeling through my feet and the percent, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm going to aim it 3 inches to the right and I hit it and it only breaks an inch and a half. And then, okay, wait a minute, something was wrong. So I have to go back and determine where I got it wrong. But from my experience, John, at least they can quantify to some degree why they overread it or underread it. So it starts to teach them kind of what their tendencies would be, it per se. Do you have the same experience? And is there something else that you think it kind of helps a player understand better?
No, I think you nailed it right on the head. It's 1,000,000% that. And the other thing I find interesting is when they get it right, they feel doubly better that they made it, because not only did they make it, but they did all the things that they were supposed to do to get it right and be like, okay, I felt it right, I aimed it right, I hit it right, and it went in. Like, all of the boxes were ticked. And it's like, I got it like 100%. Where sometimes if they're just kind of looking at it and they hit it, they're like, oh, they're happy that they made it. But it's a different culmination of skills and feel that you've done to get there. And then what you'd said about being able to determine what you got right and what you didn't is rewarding in terms of, I don't know why it didn't go in. Like, you can figure it out. I either did this right. or this, and then I can learn and then I can improve. I can see a pattern. I can see a tendency. I can work through it. And that was the main reason I got into it 15 years ago, was it answered the why question of green readings. Like, well, I don't know why I didn't go in. Now I could figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Do you think JT is already starting to kind of understand maybe some of what his tendency may be? And then from your perspective, do you think like a little bit of that learning is going to, you know, perhaps be the answer that's going to, you know, flip the switch here a little bit and get him where the ball is going to be going in, and he's starting to see that and he builds confidence. And all of a sudden we know when JT starts to go, like, look out, right? He starts to fill it up.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. He's very good at going when he can get going. And I think that's absolutely the case. You know, this is his first time on Bent. Bent feels a little different than Bermuda to him. So he started out a little bit feeling lower than what it had been, but as the days have gone on, it's caught right back up, and now he's feeling it really, really true to what he's dealing with.
What do you mean lower? It feels lower to him.
Oh, sorry. He was feeling less than what it was on the Bent surfaces, than he was at Wells on the Bermuda and the overseed. And that could just be the environment. It could be the firmness of the ground. It could be a whole bunch of things. But the week he started out, he was feeling it less than what it was and missing a bunch low. But again, being able to say, you know, exactly why made it easier to work through.
Yeah, it feels like it's bubbling up for it, doesn't it? It kind of feels like that there's going to be a turn for the good here. He was positive 1.4. at Wells Fargo, where he finished 14th. I mean, his driver seems to be in a good spot. We know sometimes his driver can go a little astray, but it's in a good spot. His iron game has been very consistent. You know, I think his short game, you know, more times than not, you don't really have to worry about with JT.
Exactly.
But it feels like it's bubbling up. And then, you know, all of a sudden you see a couple balls go in and you're like, oh, wow, I'm kind of dialed in here a little bit more and I'm quantifying it, and your confidence goes up, and then, you know, off you go. So, yeah, it's an interesting game. And I'll finish up with this. You know, sometimes do you feel, John, just as a coach in general, because we have a lot of coaches that listen to the podcast, and, you know, when you're working with players, whether it's a Justin Thomas, you also work with Adam Svensson. We talked about Jason Day, and I know you've got your hands in on so many other players and some you can't tell us about, which I respect. but is it, are there times where you're like, man, we're putting the work in and statistically it's not exactly what we want. Mm-hmm. The ball's not going in as much as we want. But it really does come down to just some patience and letting things kind of fall into place. I mean, is it really that simple at times with players where you're just like, let's just keep doing what we're doing and the ball will go in?
Yeah, and that's way harder said there, or way harder done than said.
Especially when they're texting you at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, I mean it's a different environment that I can only train with them when they're not competing. And mm-hmm. and competing is different than practice and training. And mm-hmm. I see the things I see when we train, and I try to see what I see on the course from 30 yards away as I'm looking outside the ropes. And but then I can't recreate the feelings and the emotions that are running through them mm-hmm. on the golf course and the training environment to the same degree. Like, we can gamble, we can do things to try to get closer to that. But the actual environment produces stuff in people, and it's trying to figure out, okay, what do I need to do here that actually transfers out on the golf course that they can then go with. And I think that part is the patience piece, because it's usually like an evolution, like a little bumps here and there that kind of move in the direction you're trying to go, and then all of a sudden you're putting better, but it doesn't feel like you've made this huge jump. It's just like, okay, now I'm making more six footers like I should be making, so they don't seem special. It's like, well, I should be making those anyways. And then as you start to look at the statistics, they start to improve over time. But it doesn't feel necessarily like I went from, you know, really struggling to really great. It's mm-hmm. always like this slow little kind of stock market trend that's kind of up and down, moving in a positive direction.
It you know, it's such a good point too, because like some guys and women that you work with, when they get into competition, they get near the lead, like they may embrace that differently and run towards the fire per se. Like a JT, like
exactly.
he feels like someone who, okay, we're in the hunt. Come on, guys, let's go. We're running right straight at this guy. You know, yeah. here we go. Yeah. And then others, they get in the fire and they're like, they push back. They're like, yeah. they maybe get a little more timid, right? Because it hits them yeah. differently. Like, correct. I think that's something Tony Finau had to work through in his distance yeah. control. Like, you know, he would tend to not hit his putts as aggressively. So, you know, everybody's a little different when they get into that moment that hits them. And I would imagine, and I'll finish with this, I would imagine that like that conversation is fascinating with, and how different that conversation can be with each yeah. player.
Yeah. And the difficulty can be is that it's can be very fleeting. Like, they might have that twice a year. It's like, we're trying to prepare for this thing that we might not see for 6 months from now. It's a difficult task, because you try to prepare for it, and then the situation comes and it's like, oh, okay, well that didn't work out as well as we'd like. Okay, do we need to make an adjustment? Do we keep with it? You know, and because it's not necessarily going to happen next week, there's a little bit of, you know, educated guessing going on, trying to figure out, like, okay, here's what we are seeing, here's what you're saying, here's what we're watching. And let's start planning for the next time this comes around and see how we get through this. It's really interesting. It's a really cool puzzle. I mean, I thoroughly love what I do because yeah. of that piece of it. It's just never the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're doing a good job, man. Hopefully, JT gets it. JT sees the ball going a few times. Great stuff with Jason Day, and also great stuff with Adam Svensson, who comes in 27th at Wells Fargo. Positive 4.3 putting there, and you know, a talented young player. I know he won the RSM Classic, and yeah. That was a big moment for him. So it seems like he's moving in the right direction as well when it comes to the flat stick. John, we really appreciate your time, man. Have Thanks. A great week at Rochester. Go sit by that fire and warm up.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.